Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of You Belong in AI. This podcast is made possible by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. My name is Arjun Subramanian, and today my co-host is going to be Shirvani Jha. Our guest is Luca Soleini. Luca is an applied scientist at Amazon Alexa working on web question answering for Alexa. In the past, he has worked on natural language understanding for Amazon Alexa as well. He's a former member of the Information Retrieval Lab at Georgetown University. He obtained his PhD in computer science at Georgetown University, and his dissertation work was focused on improving access to medical information by bridging the knowledge gap between health information seekers and medical content. Outside of AI, Luca is an activist for queer representation. He is a part of We Are Gage, which is the Georgetown Alliance of Graduate Employees, and he is also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Welcome, Luca, to the You Belong in AI podcast. Really glad to have you. So I just wanted to start off by asking you a little bit about your background. So in particular, what inspired you to pursue CS? Talk about your experience getting your bachelor's, your master's, PhD, et cetera, in CS.
Yeah, really glad to be over. We're looking forward to this conversation. So I don't have like a cutesy story about how I got into CS and engineering. It's just something that I was always been fascinated with. My dad is a mechanical engineer, so got the knack pretty early. And as I was wrapping up high school, I was sort of looking around, always been interested in science stuff. So I decided to pursue a Bachelor of Engineering. No real reason why I chose that over CS. So it was engineering, it was computer engineering instead of computer science. No real reason why I chose that over computer science. It was just I'm from Italy. In Italy, you often go to the university that is closest to you. You typically don't move much. If you have a decent institution right where you are from. I'm from Florence. University of Florence happened to be, was very close to home. And at least in Florence, looking at the faculty of in the engineering department, the computer science department, I happen to like the people in the engineering department more. The curriculum was pretty close, so I chose to go with computer engineering. So I got my Bachelor of Engineering from Florence. And, I enjoyed the subject, wasn't super sure what I was going to do next. When I was done with my degree, I got lucky enough that my undergrad university had an exchange program set up with Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. So I was lucky enough that during my junior year, I was able to do 6 months at Georgetown University. Where I met my future advisor. I was taking one of her classes. The class was information retrieval. Really enjoyed the class, really enjoyed the subject. It was one of those cool classes where the instructor will bring in a lot of research into the class. So a lot of, this is sort of common with a lot of upper class in undergraduate degree, where the cool instructors will find relevant papers that are they're accessible for undergrads, and at the same time can give you a little bit more information on what's actually happening on this subject in the research world. So I got my first like exposure to research through this class that I took, an exchange student. And while my semester as an exchange student was wrapping up, this professor in pursuing a PhD degree, and she said she would be interested in advising me through the degree if I were to apply at Georgetown. And that's how I decided to join the PhD program there. Had a fantastic 5 years with my advisor, Nezel Goharian. And after that, after a few good internship throughout the PhD, I decided to pursue a career in industry and do research in industry.
Awesome. That sounds really cool. So just going on to the next question we have. So when you were a student, did your university's CS communities suffer from a lack of representation of diverse backgrounds or experiences or minority groups? And how do you identify? Was it difficult to be open while a student?
So this is an interesting question. I had to think a little bit because sometimes I tend to like overlap my experience as like studying in the US versus studying in Italy. I would say that back during my undergrad, Italy is still a little bit behind when it comes to bringing the issue of representation in a university setting, in the sense that, you know, as a country, it's pretty open. I was lucky enough that family environment was really good. Friends group were really good. But in terms of like bringing the issue of representation in academic or work setting, it's either further behind than the US. So definitely suffer a little bit from just a lack of like overlap between how things look like, you know, the issues of personal identities in my personal life versus representation in academic or work environment. I personally identify as gay, and I use pronouns he, him. And really during my undergrad, there was like a lack of having any kind of role model or any kind of like person that, you know, would embrace my personal identity with my academic and work interest. To give you like a very simple example, in the US, a lot of universities now have LGBTQ centers, and they do wonderful work to like bridging different sides of the community. And especially on undergrad level, like they offer their like first place where you know, you can do this connection between life at university and then your academic experience at the university. And such support structures are completely non-existent in Italy. So it's a little bit there's a strong disconnect there.
Oh, yeah, I'm really sorry to hear that, but I really hope that representation and these kind of resources that are available to students of all identities improves, you know, both here and abroad. So just kind of continuing on the topic of representation, why do you personally think representation is really important, especially in CS and AI, and even at the university level? Do you think representation has improved at universities over the past couple of decades? And do you think it's easier to be open now at a university?
It's definitely improved quite a bit, you know, from having centers at university to just having like people in the community who are open to a lot of also like researchers creating communities around their identities in their own field. For example, in AI and CS, we have this wonderful organization called Queer in AI that has been doing a lot of like social events and panels and workshops at various academic conferences that are focused on themes that are either like specific for the LGBT community or adjacent to the LGBT community. So broader issues of representation and having fair research in this area. It's not equally distributed. You have pockets where the situation is really good and you have very welcoming environments, a lot of good research is directly either directly for our community or takes into consideration aspects that are crucial for our community. And then you have other pockets where we might as well be 25 years ago, 30 years ago, just from the standpoint of lack of representation. So, you know, it would be nice if it was a little bit more evenly distributed versus, you know, having to navigate the space and try to find which communities and which, you know, universities or departments or conferences are more respecting of our need as a community.
Yeah, that's some really great insight. I remember when you were presenting at the Queer Hacks, at the Queer Hacks event, you were talking about how there was that they had developed an AI system that would use facial recognition for the purposes of gaydar, and you know how that was completely debunked. And we definitely have come a long way since then. You were talking about the what Queer and AI does. I was reading about one of their workshop topics, which I believe was related to the preventing the erasure of non-binary pronouns in natural language processing and natural language generation. And so I think that's really cool that they have a lot of these, they're discussing a lot of these topics that are very directly related to issues that the LGBTQIA community is facing. And on top of that, they're making these AI systems behave a lot more equitably for like everyone that's using them.
Yeah, it's natural inclination of a lot of like this applied research to try to sort of assume things in ways that are a little bit too simplistic for the sake of achieving whatever goals, right? You know, you can imagine that assuming that non-binary people or people who are not fall strictly in the binary gender definition do not exist, because that makes your assumption around whatever you're trying to do in your research much easier. You know, it's important that the work that some research have been doing lately in really try to express the need of measuring and including more than just, you know, the simple approach and the reductionist approach, and also in quantifying, hey, what is the harm there that we create when we make these choices?
Yeah, definitely. So you were talking about how there are these pockets, right, within AI that maybe you're maybe not as welcome in, whereas there are also like pockets, because again, it's not evenly distributed, where you do feel more welcome because they're very respectful of different identities and they try to explore topics that are adjacent or relevant to different groups. So how would you, what kind of improvements would you want to see, and how evenly distributed this kind of feeling of being welcome of all identities is in the AI community? And what other improvements would you want to see in terms of representation and inclusion in general from the CS and AI community?
That's a very good question. I think it's it's two aspects. One of it is bringing forward these topics, you know, from long overdue things like code of conducts at conferences, which I'm happy to say that a lot of conferences have been adopting recently in the space, both more like AI conference like near IPS or iClear, and also in NLP conferences, all ACL conferences now adopt code of conduct as well. But you know, that's just the first step. I think a broader understanding of how there is much more than, you know, the default setting in which research has been conducted, it's a very important topic. For example, from LGBTQ representation to just like, you know, when you do any research that could affect our community, to just put front and center what is the ethical implication or the effect in general that research can do to our community. If you're looking from race point of view, moving away from, you know, you mentioned before, image recognition, and the fact is that a lot of image recognition, especially when applied to human, assumes as default appearance, a lot of samples, a lot of like the default appearance is just white people. Similarly, when doing any research that includes gender at all, just having a broader understanding of what are the different, broader understanding of how your research affects different definition of gender, different gender identities. And, you know, it comes down to the fact that we have researchers that have been doing awesome job and that are at the forefront of this kind of trying to have this intersectional view on research. We need to do a lot more to normalize this aspect and to really make sure that, you know, these are standard scientific practice, the same way other practices in science have long been accepted. And then the other aspect is, you know, you need to make sure to be able to bring people from outside, people who are underrepresented in the community. Important step there is, like, you know, just putting money there, you know, having more scholarships, having more travel grants, having more, you know, making sure that, you know, once you assign a travel grant, then depending on the need of person who got this travel grant, they have the right support group and their needs are met at conferences, both in terms of accessibility, you know, system, so that if this is their first conference in this area, they're not sort of left out to navigate this conference on their own. If you are in the mainstream definition of people who do research in this area, a lot of the structure naturally exists for you. You know, there is a implicit buddy system that forms up. So you need to balance for those who are maybe from an era when there are where, you know, they are sort of underrepresented, so they don't have this naturally forming communities at conferences. You do your best to, both from a financial point of view and from a structural point of view, you build this support system for them.
Yeah, those are some really great ideas for improvements. I really hope that all that stuff gets instated within the next, I know, one or two decades at, you know, at most, hopefully. And I'm really glad, especially with regards to the point you made about having a community. I know that there are a lot of things that involve, like, pairing up with people. For example, if you want to room for a conference, you usually need to find roommates, and that can obviously be very hard if you don't have a community around you already, especially, for example, if you're queer. And so I think it's great that queer and AI exists so that we have, like, access to a community, and you don't have to work very hard to find other people who share your identity. It's just, it's just, you know, at the, you just have to kind of respond to an email that's sent out, and you get emails from other people as well. It's just at your fingertips almost. So I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit here and go slightly away from just generally representation and inclusion, but, you know, please feel free to touch upon those topics while we discuss the next question. So what internships did you have while obtaining your PhD? And this question is very much for our listeners who are really want to have some good professional development and really want to pursue that PhD and get into research. What have you been doing since you graduated? And it would also be great if you could simultaneously discuss, you know, how easy or hard it's been to be open in the workplace. Maybe your changing attitude towards being out over the years. And if you just have any tips in general for people pursuing PhDs, doing their internships, anything else related to that?
Yeah. So I will preface this that, you know, if listeners are familiar with internships in undergrad, that's not, it's actually very similar, the reason why you do an internship during a PhD. You know, it's twofold, really. It's a question of, you know, you gain experience in a different setting, you know, changing setting in which you do research. It's always useful. And it also, it's a good way for you to decide what you want and don't want to do after. So when it relates to academia, you know, one of the two big directions you can take. There are a million paths that you can take after you get your degree, but the two big ones is you might decide to go to industry, or you might want to stay in academia instead. So on one side, you know, you get your degree and then you get hired at either some companies or do some, you know, contracting, something like that for scientific institution or industry. The other side, you finish your PhD, you typically go and do postdoc, and then you enter the academic job market, roughly. My goal, I think it's a shared goal that a lot of people have doing internships, doing a PhD, is just to get a feel of which way you want to go. You know, being the fact that you are a university for 9 months of the year, you get natural exposure to what it means to do academic research, as well as, you know, you see your advisor having to write grants, you know, do all sorts of like academic function, either like to the outside community or to the university as well. And so you get a good feeling for that, good feeling of how it works. So for the remaining maybe 3 months of a year, given that we are in a field that is really open to having interns and has a lot of opportunities as a student, you're gonna get a feel of like how things work in industry. So during my PhD, I was lucky enough to have three very different internships in three different industries. So my first one was an innovation center at MedStar Health, which is a regional hospital in the US on the East Coast. It's one of the two big ones, the other one being Johns Hopkins. The cool thing there is that I was able to intern at this research center where the experts surrounding me were not computer science experts. There were a lot of like doctors in human factors. That's the field of studying how safety, especially in the medical field, how like the process that you implement in healthcare can impact safety and ability to make decision. I was, of course, being a healthcare institution, I was surrounded by a lot of doctors with a ton of medical experience. And so my internship there really gave me perspective of like, okay, how does it work in an interdisciplinary lab where, you know, you might be working on something where you are the expert on the technology itself, but you're not the expert on the topic. So you have to like interface your experience as a researcher in your field with experiences in other fields. This is a common industry application that I don't think is discussed enough in when you know, you think about, oh, I'm gonna go and work from one of the FANG companies. This setting where, you know, you're the expert in your area, but you're working on an application where you might not know much, is actually a lot common. And so it's good to have some experience in that. I was also able to intern at Microsoft in their research group. I did an internship for one of their innovation centers in Israel. And so that was similar to like a research lab in the sense that I was able to work on a research project where I was able to use Microsoft infrastructure and data to carry out this research. So what I looked at during that period is I looked at ways to improve access to healthcare on web search engines. So I was able to work with, you know, directly with Bing data and an API to do some research application. I also did an internship at Amazon. That was during my final year of the PhD. The goal of the internship was twofold. First of all, the early part of my PhD was focused a lot on information retrieval, which is adjacent to natural language processing, use some machine learning. But I wanted to get more into natural language processing because, like, you know, during the 5 years of my PhD, I felt that that was an area that I had more interest in. And the second is something that, you know, it's, I'm sure the listener will have a lot of experience. It's your last year. You want to do an internship and get a full-time return offer. You know, it's because if you getting a return offer like that, it's much, it's a lot lower stress than, you know, having to go through rounds of interviews and whole hiring dance that you have to do during your last year. And I was lucky enough there to get a return offer and to be able to join Amazon full time.
That's great to hear. So I was just wondering if you could kind of touch really quickly upon for students who want to really boost their chances of getting these internships during their PhD, and maybe they also share an identity that is where they're not sure like how open they can be in the workplace. Like, what tips would you have for them?
Cold emailing people is actually surprisingly effective in the sense that both from, you know, especially if you are like part of the minority group, there is a strong sense of like immediate sense of community when you someone who is in same affinity group as you reaches out to you. I personally enjoy receiving emails and you know, asking for advice, even asking if we have position open for internship. It's something that, you know, I think you can easily do will encourage people to do it. From the side of being in industry, from our side, it's actually surprisingly hard to spread the word out for internships. And it's due to the fact that, you know, I'm part of one of many, many, many research groups who are looking for summer interns. And we all happen to look for summer interns at the same time. So there's a flood of information of like, oh, you know, there's hundreds of groups are looking for summer interns all at the same time. So if the ability to, you know, establish connection with potential candidates actually helps us a lot in looking for interns. And, you know, after initial connection, then it's all up to you in terms of like going through the hiring process. But we are happy to receive like, you know, emails and people wanting to connect and seeing, you know, what the situation is there. We, you know, this is something that happens a lot at conferences, but conferences have a barrier to entry in the sense you typically go if you have some work published there. But, you know, even before that, you can definitely get in touch with people directly and see what the situation is there.
Yeah, thank you for those tips. Those sound really good, and I really hope that they help anyone listening to the podcast. So now I'm going to turn the questions over to Shravani.
Yeah, for sure. Hi. So I'm going to break this next question into two parts. So for the first part, we'd love to hear more about your role in essentially just improving Amazon Alexa. So if you could start off with a definition of what applied science is for people who may be listening who aren't familiar with the term, and describe some of your projects, that would be a great first start.
Cool. Applied science is it's a very broad term that you know, it's Amazon encompasses a lot of jobs, and it's a little bit tricky because it's not consistent across companies. But in general, majority of scientists at these companies that have, you know, both a product and a research division would spend their time working on technologies that enable certain functionality. So it could be, for example, you could, let's say you're working on Alexa and you are trying to work on the part that the speech recognition that turns speech into text. You would investigate algorithms, methods that can do this. You borrow from research applications. So you might borrow ideas and technology from the research community. You might develop on something of your own. You might reshare this technology through publication back to the research community. And you essentially work on the part that deals with the core science. Okay, what algorithm, what machine learning technique to use for this? And then once you know you have established sort of my minimal viable product there, or proof of concept system, then you work closely with the engineers and the various product manager company to make sure that, you know, your idea, your proof of concept can actually slot into the complex system that form any of these, case of virtual assistant, the complex pipelines that are built in place to make this product work.
Yeah, that sounds super cool. And also definitely relevant to a lot of people's interests based on my personal interactions with individuals at UCLA. So building off of that, what kind of projects do you work on for Amazon? And what's your favorite part about working on Amazon and working on those initiatives?
Yeah, so I currently work in a group that does web-based question answering. So we build a system that receives part of the traffic in Alexa. Typically those questions that are more complex and are you know, not easy to answer. And we use natural language processing technologies to retrieve possible answers from the web, and then from these possible answers to score the most likely answer for this question. And so it's a combination, it's really nice because it builds off my background. It's a combination of information retrieval systems, because if you're searching on the web, you need to have an efficient way to retrieve web pages and then possible answers from these web pages. And then it also uses a lot of natural language processing techniques to actually analyze questions, answers, find similarity, assess how likely is an answer, a candidate to be an answer to a given question. So it's really cool how it is at the intersection of a lot of my previous experience, and I'm able to tie up a lot of different research areas. And in terms of like, what is the most exciting part of working on this project is, it's really just the sheer scale that you are working on here that lets you, that introduces different challenges of what you have in academia, of traditional like question answering research in academia, both in terms of like, how do you make this more efficient? How do you make sure that, you know, you cover the broad range of topics that people can ask? But also you get a lot of validation from users that you can directly see and you can directly use to improve your product. When you do research in academia, you sort of have this idealized idea of, this is going to question answering, this is correctness, this is what I expect, this is how my system, I expect my system to work. You can define it, you can state it, but then when you work in a setting where you have real users interacting with your product, definitions get a little bit messy. But also at the same time, you have a lot of more leeway in try to make sense of those and then improve your product and then see the direct effect on those who are using your product.
Yeah, that all sounds super cool, especially like the high level overview of how like Amazon Alexa works, and especially what you were saying about like the sheer like scale of like people that you like help and like also like the problems that you have to solve. My roommate keeps talking to our Alexa even though she left it at school for the past several weeks, so I think that shows you how much it's ingrained in our lives. And we also spent several nights just asking Alexa the most random questions we could think of just to see what she would say back, and it's a really fun process. And like especially when you look at it from a technical lens, like how are you actually thinking about like the questions we're asking Alexa and how you go about solving them, it's a really, really cool problem to think about. So yeah, kind of going more into like the representation side of it, how easy or hard is it to be open at Amazon? How's like the general work culture? And then what employee resource groups are there for queer and trans individuals and or pride related events at the company?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's easy in certain sense and hard in others. The easy part is that Amazon, in terms of like protection for, and you know, speaking of Amazon here, but that's, it's good that this seems to be like a trend in Silicon Valley in general, and a lot of tech companies that they seem to have the basics well squared in sense of their hiring process, at least is clear. Clearly states that, you know, there are protection against discrimination in terms of, and it's equally the same inside a company. There are mechanisms in place to make sure that, you know, there are the right channels to report any discrimination. Now, personally, I consider that those kind of resources should be the norm in any workplace, not just, they shouldn't be considered a plus in companies that have it. They should be like really widespread everywhere. So, you know, it's good in that sense, but like as many, like other many workplaces, it's covering the basics, but at least that's there. In terms of, internal groups, Amazon has had for, I don't know, I think closer to 20 years, their Glamazon internal group. They nailed the name. So this is the affinity group for anyone who identifies LGBTQ plus in Amazon. Like many of Amazon organizations, they have a regional structure. So they have chapter in Seattle, chapter down here in LA, and they're involved in different ways with the community. So I know, for example, here in LA, there's a mix of, you know, participating to public events like Pride. There are several panels that occur internally that deal with topics that are relevant to the LGBT community, or spotlight figures, both internal and external figures in the LGBT community. And also we have a few collaboration with the LGBTQ Center here in LA on a couple of initiatives throughout the year. In terms of like, you know, how well you're represented, how well is it to find peers, it's very similar to the academic setting in the sense that you might have, you might be in an office, like in a physical office location or in a team where so happens that there is more representation, or you might be in a team where you are the only queer identifying person in that team. Personally, I've worked with several teams within Amazon. I never had any issue with my identity being disrespected or not acknowledgement. I'm also lucky enough that, you know, being gay, using he him pronouns is definitely easier to get, you know, to be respected versus some of the trans folk, some of the, especially those of color. So it's definitely easier for me versus what others in our community might experience. But yeah, it varies a lot in terms of like, are you able to find peers and like-minded people? That varies a lot. Just because like, you know, in many areas, the distribution and where our community is not evenly distributed.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And also like, thank you so much for like bringing a lot of nuance to your answers, like both about like working at Amazon and also about like representation in Amazon, because it's really nice to hear like at least an acknowledgement about like the fact that like different intersections of identities can lead to different experiences. But I'm really glad that you've like had a positive experience at Amazon so far. It means a lot, especially because it's like such a like important like company in the tech sphere and like in the world in general. But yeah, back to more technical things, we will pass it back to Arjun.
Just kind of following up really quickly too on what you were saying earlier, like I think it's definitely great that a lot of these big tech companies have been very good about clearly stating that there's no discrimination in the hiring process, that they're very careful to make sure that everyone, regardless of background or identity, gets to participate in a fair hiring process. And so they usually do list a lot of legally protected classes. One of the startups that I was working with last summer, at least on their website, it wasn't clear that, I think they initially started off in the LA area, and so sexual orientation was not something that they said that was protected underneath their hiring practices and their service offers. And they, although they did start in the LA area, they were growing very fast nationally. So, and obviously, like we know that in the US, sexual orientation is not a legally protected class federally, even though it is in California. And so I think it's really important that you know, companies, regardless of whether they're like these, like the big four in the Silicon Valley, or whether they're small startups in Silicon Beach, I think it's important to make sure that they're very clear that everyone is going to get a fair hiring practice.
Yeah, and it's it gives, so you know, there is I personally feel a sense of responsibility in making sure that the hiring is done in respects this category that are sitting in the books. Clearly, we are all, you know, at the end of the day, it's humans who are making these hiring decisions, right? So biases at individual levels will crop up no matter what. But the nice thing about having this framework, this protected class in establishing the hiring framework, it means that you as an individual part of a hiring loop can sort of point fingers of the book and saying, hey, we need to be able to do a better job with this candidate because our framework, and you feel validated by the framework that you're working with. There's a lot of still personal responsibility. And, you know, as us as a member of the community both need to, like, you know, embrace when hiring, as well as try to communicate, especially those who are like me, are like in a fortunate position, you know, maybe, you know, an identity being less affected by discriminatory hiring practices in general, and also being on the other side. We still need to set up as individual and do our best to make sure that these protected status are actually correctly reflected.
Yeah, definitely. So now I want to dive a little bit into something more technical. So I was wondering what interests you about natural language processing and, you know, adjacently information retrieval, and what interests you about AI more broadly?
That's a very good question. I personally like how language applications are fun to work with because they get a little bit messy in the sense that and especially like if you work on applications like mine are more focused on the semantics and try to understand language. That's, you know, in a nutshell what question answering boils to, what you know, a virtual assistant boils to is to trying to make to like sort of model and understand meaning in a specific task in a specific setting. It's, I find, I personally really enjoy the challenge of try to model and how to best approach these problems from a computational point of view. If one stops and thinks about it just for a few minutes, you understand that, you know, there's fundamental disconnect there, what you're trying to do there. And it's a very interesting problem to find the right approximation, the right mathematical approximation for the problem you're trying to solve. Being question answer, where you like, you have to understand, okay, what makes an answer something that what makes something correct, an answer for a question, and you can start breaking down. You can start thinking about, okay, is this a valid answer? Is this a correct answer? Is this a complete answer? Is this an answer that it's presentable, right? So there are different ways in which you can break down the definition of you know, semantically correctness in terms of an answer for a question. And I think it's a very interesting area in the sense that you're trying to, because you're trying to map something that it's naturally blurred in terms of like definition into a framework that tries to have very cut and defined lines. And also it's fascinating how it's an era where humans are tasks that are trivially easy for humans, where, you know, where we apply common sense knowledge to solve this task. And yet they're so hard to solve from a machine point of view using an algorithm because, you know, there is so much layering in the condition, in the capabilities of how humans fundamentally solve these problems versus what, you know, an algorithm has.
Yeah, I really like your answer related to just kind of the dichotomy there between how humans are able to just look at this raw natural language, which seems to have no structure and may be ambiguous, but we instantly are able to collect all this context and kind of get a very succinct understanding of what's being said almost instantaneously. Whereas that when we try to apply these very clean cut algorithms that in the past have relied very much on structure, like whether that be in terms of like how the algorithm operates or whether that be in terms of the data that's being passed into the algorithm, it's really hard for it to deal with this very raw data.
Just to add a little bit of example, in case any of the listener wants to hear more about it, there is this very fascinating task that is called common sense reasoning, where you're trying to computationally solve and reason over factual statements. And a lot of them deal with background knowledge that we all have. So you present an algorithm, two sentences. One is the cat is inside the box. The other one is the box is inside the cat. And you have to assess which one is, you know, it's valid and, you know, from a reasoning point of view, and which one is invalid. And for, it's a very simple task for human, even if you move away from like this, like simple, you know, subject, verb, object statements, even if you include clauses and things like that, we have a lot of background knowledge to solve any of these tasks. You know, making sure that our algorithm can consistently solve this type of question is incredibly tricky. So this is one of many examples of tasks that are where, you know, the way a human fundamentally process that information is very different to how you would go and solve it using a machine.
Yeah, awesome. Actually, you're like one step ahead of me. When I was going to say, and so I was going to ask if you give like a really good example of that, but you were already there. And so I really like your kind of very high level, very theoretical examples of like why the problem of NLP and information retrieval and AI more broadly is very exciting for you and makes you very passionate about working in the field. So just touching on how you said that as an applied scientist, you do have to do these proofs of concept. You have to make sure that these ideas for algorithms or applications of models work. And then you have to talk to the engineers too about the feasibility of integrating these models into the current framework. So I guess like in terms of interest or passion, if you have any related to this, are there any tools that you like to work with in particular that could be related to natural language processing? Maybe if you're using like EC2 instances all the time, is that something that you like to work with?
Yeah. So this is not different from, you know, it's a process similar to like actually publishing research. I was surprised when I joined how similar is the building a proof of concept to then talk about and work with the engineers is very similar to like how you do research. So the tools there's a lot of overlap, from the hardware side. You know, you might have you might work with EC2. Well, we particularly work with EC2 a lot, being that, it's Amazon builds it. And so you can imagine it's a lot easier for us to work with internally built tools. But this is not different from doing research on a cluster setup that you might have in your university information center, something like that. Software wise, again, there it's like very similar. We are lucky enough that the machine learning research community has converged on like Python and Python tooling in terms of software used for a lot of the research there. So you can imagine that, depending on what you're trying to do, you might use tools from different kinds of tools from in the ecosystem. This can go from your deep learning frameworks, either PyTorch or TensorFlow, to things like, okay, now I need to build a simple web service that can serve the prediction. So you might use Django or Flask or any other kind of these technologies. And it's nice the fact that you're working. This is one of the things that I like, the fact that you're working in this pre-engineering step. You have a lot of liberty on how you deliver these kind of tools. I want to also include a shout out for those who might be interested into the engineering part of you. This is not something that I have the background or the knowledge to be proficient in, but I know that from colleagues in the team who work on that side, there's also a lot to do on, okay, this scientist built this system for me, but it runs in seconds, right? And now I need to like make it 2-3 orders of magnitude faster to actually use it in production. And I have to build pipelines that receives input and output and do that in a secure way. Even for those who are interested in more of the applied scientists, the applied engineering side of machine learning, there's a lot to do there in terms of like bringing that software to a state that it's actually functional.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. So I'm going to turn the question over to Shirvani again.
Yeah, for sure. So we would love it if you could speak once again to the importance of representation in AI. So specifically, what are some ways that representation matters at Amazon in working on Alexa and in natural language processing in general?
Yeah. So you know, Amazon is a technology company that builds consumer product. So you can imagine how, like, you know, having a clear understanding of the consumers interact with the product and make sure that, you know, your system is well designed for consumers from all backgrounds, all social identities, and so on is important. So for one of the big ways from a voice assistant, you can imagine is that given the many, many differences in accents and origin of our users, you need to be able to be equally proficient regardless of how people speak to a device. I know this is not something I've been personally involved with, but you know, the Alexa division has worked on multilingual support for any of these devices, to things like, you know, make sure that when a kid speaks to any of these devices, you can actually understand, you know, despite maybe the limited speaking ability of a 2, 3, 4 year old. You know, when develop these technologies, inclusivity, it's in the sense of like making sure that your product is accessible and usable, you know, by everyone, by a diverse set of the population. In terms of NLP in general, representation, you know, spans very broadly in terms of like how we can best make sure that the tools that we use are free of any behavior that might damage or might cause a system to be not as effective with people in a certain group. And so it's important there to, and the issue of the presentation there is not only on the product itself, like making sure that it works that way, but also I found that, you know, it's important to have people have that experience, that set of experience in the room when these tools are designed, in order to make sure that, you know, actually all the T are crossed and all the I's are dotted. We can, you know, intersectionality and representation is messy in the sense that, messy in a good way, in the sense that, you know, no two experiences are alike and no group can speak for another underrepresented group. And there is no one size fits all solution. So it's important to talk about representation when it comes to like, hey, let's make sure that our system works right. But people who build the system, also people from different backgrounds who want to build the system need to be able to be involved into the research side so that there is no disconnect there.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I think your answer definitely speaks to like the universal scale of like, not only like the general like problems that you're trying to solve in natural language processing, but also like the like growing reach of the products that you develop, especially as the world becomes more cosmopolitan and interconnected via technology. So passing it back to Arjun to go back to the academic stuff.
Yeah, so earlier you were talking about as you do these internships, during your PhD, like the contrast between maybe working in academia, working in industry. Obviously, you're working in industry currently. So I was just wondering if you could speak to the pros and cons of working in industry versus academia. What advice would you give to students who are trying to figure out in which direction they should proceed?
So assuming that you have some research goals, some research interests, the big difference is how you structure your environment to work around this interest. In the sense that if you work in academia and you are in academia, you have a given research interest, primary way in which you are able to work towards that interest is that you have to work, you know, to have the necessary funding and the necessary collaborators and the necessary, you know, tools in order to do that research. So there's a lot of, you typically look for grant money, or you work in an institution that gives you, you know, a seed package to do research. You have to cultivate, you know, nowadays, especially now, no one does research alone all the time. So you have to have a network of collaborators you are happy with and you're productive with. You might want to have students to work with, both in terms of, like, you know, building the future generation of scientists, but also, you know, not working on projects alone and be able to explore different areas at the same time. So in academia, you really have to build this framework around on your own. I don't have direct experience in this, not having gone that route, but I can tell you that it's common knowledge that there's quite a bit of overhead when you start, in order to, like, you know, actually build that working environment that you need to pursue your research. Especially moving from, like, a PhD, where you sort of get that environment for granted, you know, you have your advisor, that's your de facto collaborator, to actually having to build that up on your own. In industry, you know, if you are lucky to get a position at a company that works in an area that you're interested in, that structure is sort of already in place for you. It's the product that industry lab is building. And so that's the upside. You know, you don't have to build in. The other side, you know, there's a little bit divergence all the time between what company interest might be, what your personal research interests are. And so there's a little bit of juggling there in trying to best align. There are a lot of realities that sort of live in between. So for example, for NLP, you have a lot of, for AI in general, you have a lot of industry-like environments that focus more on research. So you have the Allen Institute for AI, you have even like subdivision companies like DeepMind, or you have OpenAI. They're all research institutions that sort of have like a company-ish modus operandi. So they sit somewhat in the middle, and you will see in this area like traits from one side and traits from the other side.
Yeah, thank you. I think that gives a lot of the people who are listening to us a very good idea of what the environment is going to be like in industry versus in academia. And hopefully, I definitely know that it's like a kind of something that everyone has to figure out for themselves, right? Whether they want to go into industry or academia, but it's really great that you're able to provide this context for what they can expect as they work through their PhD and are trying to make their decision.
I'm going to make another point on that, I think it's a little bit of a misconception, especially when starting. Like, I had conversation with either prospective PhD student, junior PhD students, who think that you have to make that decision like super early on in your PhD. And that's definitely not the case. You can, you know, it's something that will come sort of naturally. You will naturally, at least in my personal experience, you tend to naturally lean in a certain way as you progress through your PhD, as you understand more the reality of doing work there. But it's also something that, you know, you can sort of wait till the last year and a half, two of your PhD to make a decision there. And there's also like a lot of people who go back and forth, right? They will try a few years in academia and then move to a company, or those who are in a company that, you know, gradually move towards actually going back to academia.
Awesome. That's great to hear. So even I was like not very 100% sure like on when you had to make this decision. So it's great that you're able to kind of alleviate this ambiguity. And it's also nice to hear that, you know, even though like it's, you know, great to make the decision within the last 1.5 years, you can still go to industry and, you know, still do stuff with academia and vice versa. So you're never put in one place. You're never kind of boxed in once you make your decision. Yeah, so I'm going to turn to Shravani again for the last question that we're going to ask you.
So just to kind of wrap up a lot of the different points we touched on in this podcast, what is your message to youth from underrepresented groups that are interested in artificial intelligence and or computer science? And what advice would you give them if they want to get involved in these fields but aren't really sure how or where to start?
The big thing that I think I struggle a little bit, and I think everyone struggles on a different direction, is that this is something that you know, when I talked at Queer Hacks, I tried to make the point there, and hope it came across at least a little bit, is that if you want to do this, you deserve to have a seat at the table. You deserve to be able to say, okay, I want to research is what interests me. I want to go in this direction. You know, it's your given right to just go and explore the area of interest. We talked a lot today about research topics that might apply to, might improve how systems work for underrepresented group, but you know, you're not boxed to like this kind of line of work if you come from those underrepresented group. You know, the whole point is, if you wanna do research, you deserve structures and systems and support networks that allow to do that, regardless of what kind of areas of research you want to do, and regardless of what your background is, right? And I think from us who are already in the system, there is a real, I feel real eagerness when anyone who's queer reaches out personally and ask, okay, how can I get into this? I feel like a real eagerness of like, okay, this person clearly has the nick for this area. What are the ways I can help this person to thrive in whatever research environments they want to be? And so I think there is a real eagerness from those who are inside of actually seeing our interests as a community better represented in this area. So my advice is always to reach out. You know, it's a lot of us who really want to help and see and sort of give you the access that you deserve, and the connection, the networks that we're often deprived by being member of the LGBT community. That's the way that I will encourage everyone to proceed. And this happens like all sorts of different ways, right? It could happen that, you know, you might not reach out directly to someone at the company where you want to work for, but then you have like LGBTQ hire fair events where, you know, these things are prioritized. Or you might have, you know, connection through alumni network in your university, right? There are ways in which you can find the support group that puts you in the right position to pursue your research and career interest.
Thank you. That was very eloquent and also very heartwarming to hear.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to You Belong in AI. This podcast was made possible by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. Again, my name is Arjun Subramani, and my co-host today was Shirvani Jha. Today, we interviewed Luca Soldaini, who is an NLP engineer at Amazon Alexa. The script and questions you heard today were made possible by the help of our wonderful outreach officers, Maya Rahman, Kai Toda, Nisha McNeilis, Jason Jewick, Matt Ruiz, and Aman Oberoi. Furthermore, the podcast was edited by Jason Jewick. The music you hear in this podcast was composed by Kevin McLeod and is called Cheery Monday. As a reminder, please tune in again next week when we interview Jennifer LaPlante, the executive director at DeepSense, And her role involves spearheading awareness and comprehension in the ocean sector of the potential value of data, artificial intelligence, and machine learning to optimize operations, improve customer experience, and grow revenue by creating new products and services.
You belong in AI.